Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We're still here in Baltimore, Maryland at the annual fall season. Full conference of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Well, a few things I want to make sure we get to today. Since the McCarrick story broke, one of his accusers has been called just James, no last name. Yesterday, James stepped forward and revealed his last name and a fuller sense of the story. James Grine, he came forward this summer. He tells us that he was abused for 18 years by Archbishop McCarrick, and yesterday he spoke in a public setting for the first time. Christine Roussel was there. She is the D.C. correspondent for Catholic News Agency. Christine will be joining us. We'll talk about James. We'll talk about what she's seeing as a young millennial journalist and what it's like growing up in the post-2002 climate here in the United States. Also, we'll be talking with Matthew Bonson, of course, bringing us up to date as the U.S. Conference elects 6 new committee chairmen today. Teresa Tomeo will join us from Rome, and we'll also be joined by Janet Smith, who will tell us a little bit about the new organization, No More Victims. I want to mention I also serve on the board there. We'll be talking about that, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about the organization in the future as well. We're going to be joined as well by Danielle Brown, who serves on the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Ad Hoc Committee on Racism. She'll be telling us about this pastoral letter, which was supposed to be the big news, by the way, for this fall session, but clearly it was displaced. And Edward Penton joins us from Rome. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, November 14th. It's the Feast of St. Alberic of Utrecht. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, serving pro-life and Catholic causes at charitymobile.com. The National Guard is arriving in California to search for victims in the badly burned town of Paradise. The campfire has become the most destructive blaze in state history and has killed at least 48 people. The mountain's town population of 26,000 has been left as a smoldering ruin, and the Guard is sending in 100 military police officers trained to identify human remains. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says he doesn't expect the military to be involved in law enforcement actions on the southern border. Mattis and Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen are in McAllen, Texas today to assess needs at the U.S.-Mexico border. Mattis told reporters he doesn't anticipate that military personnel coming into direct contact with the migrants. Republicans are tapping Kentucky's Mitch McConnell for another term as Senate Majority Leader.
We're excited about maintaining our majority and growing our majority. We're confident we're going to have 53 Republican senators to set the agenda next year.
McConnell got the nod in a unanimous vote of the Senate Republicans today. McConnell told reporters that his top priority is ongoing confirmation of judges as President Trump continues remaking the federal judiciary. McConnell said he will try to work with House Democrats, who regained a majority in last week's midterm elections. Senate Democrats are tapping New York's Chuck Schumer for another term as minority leader. Schumer getting the nod today, unanimously. And the Justice Department says Matthew Whitaker's appointment as acting attorney general is legal. President Trump made the appointment last week after firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions. An opinion from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel says the president has legal authority to make such a move, despite the fact that Whitaker is not a Senate-confirmed appointment. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
listening to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Al Cresta here in Baltimore as we continue with the annual fall conference of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Joining me right now is Christine Roussel. She is the D.C. correspondent for Catholic News Agency. She was following the protest, and also you were there when the victim of the most publicized victim of Cardinal McCarrick.
Yeah, when he revealed his name and face publicly for the first
time. That was the first time.
Yep.
Tell me about the event.
It was a rally that was held outside of the where the Fall General Assembly is being held. And it was a solid crowd, I'd say about 200 to 300 people. And from what I saw, the probably the best-received speaker was McCarrick's alleged victim, James.
Okay, James. What did he say?
I mean, he was very, very, very nervous. You could tell. He said at one point, my whole body's shaking, and he didn't look like he was happy to be up there, but he knew that he had a story to tell. And he talked about how the abuse started when he was 11. He didn't go into any, kind of graphic details or anything.
Right.
Continued for a period of 18 years,
I didn't realize it went that long.
During which McCarrick went from being a priest in the Archdiocese of New York to being a bishop and throughout the Mid-Atlantic. And how he thought there was no way that anyone would ever believe him if he came forward with this story. But after the first abuser, who was a 16-year-old altar boy, came at the time of his abuse, came forward and was believed and published in the New York Times, and he said that he was empowered, that now was his time to, tell his story as well. And he was sharing his story in hopes to inspire other survivors of abuse to tell theirs as well.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very, very moving, and he was very well received by the crowd.
So let me clarify, though, the first victim chronologically, was it James or this 16-year-old?
I'm not sure exactly how the timeline went, but in terms of coming forward with their abuse, the first victim was the 16-year-old, the 16-year-old altar boy who came forward, and that was in, I think, late June. And then James's story was published on July 19th, if I remember correctly, and then McCarrick stepped down from the College of Cardinals about a week later.
Yeah, wow. These are compelling stories, especially when you realize that the abuse extended over 16 years.
Mm-hmm. 18 is what he
18
said.
18 years.
Yeah, almost two decades.
18 years. Did he describe how he made sense of it to himself?
He didn't really go into any details like that. He said that he didn't feel like he could tell anybody. He didn't feel like he'd be believed. He's still a very, very faithful man. He talked about how he's dedicated his life to Christ and how he has a prayer and fasting routine for the last 9,000 odd days, he said. And he called for the church basically to clean up its act, and that he said that the ghost of McCarrick will be haunting the church until things are done.
Yeah.
And the line that probably got the most applause when he said that the laws of Jesus are bigger than pontifical secrets, and that it's not Francis's church, it's Jesus Christ's church.
Right.
And that went over very, very well with the crowd that was assembled yesterday.
Well, this idea of pontifical secret, is that something that that they discussed very clearly in the protest?
Not from what I saw, the speeches that I saw, but when I was at the World Meeting of Families in Ireland, the abuse panel that was assembled on that particular topic, they discussed possibly reforming or even eliminating the pontifical secret. That was what one survivor called for.
How do you describe that pontifical secret?
I'm honestly not. I mean, my boss is with the canon lawyers, not me.
I understand. Well, the reason I ask,
but
is
I'm
because
not,
it is. One
it's
of
hard to explain in layman's terms.
You don't know
literally.
How elastic is it? You know, exactly how much does it cover? Is there a minimalist interpretation or?
Increased transparency is basically what I think the general theme of all the protesters that I've talked to throughout the weekend and those who are here demonstrating, all very peacefully, no yelling or violence or anything, but they all want transparency, they all want accountability, they all want answers, and I think their concerns are fairly reasonable.
Yeah.
They're not asking for the moon, they just want to know if their kids are going to be safe in a church, which I think is, beyond reasonable.
Yeah, I don't think anybody would dispute that that's a right that every Catholic has to expect that. I've mentioned this on the air. Two of the three priests who we've been closest to, my family, since I returned to the church in 1992, two of the three priests that we've been closest to One's laicized mm-hmm. for allegations. Another one's had his faculties revoked for allegations.
That's
not
terrible.
A great batting average.
No, that's terrible.
Yeah. And thankfully, we haven't had any problem, and we've been...
Because
we've talked it over, and we've had a very... Our present pastor is outstanding. So, somebody coming into the church right now mm-hmm. can believe what the Catholic Church teaches, is willing to behave as the Catholic Church prescribes, but has a second thought about belonging. They get the belief, they get the behavior, but then they say to themselves, do I want to belong?
No, I mean, I have friends who are currently considering RCIA or in the process now, and these are talks that we've had, and I've had to be frank of, like, we thought, a lot of people thought that the church had, you know, confronted this about a decade and a half ago, and I was still in elementary school when that was happening, and I think a lot of people assumed, okay, we did that, we're done, we have these new reforms, we're good. And this summer was a huge wake-up call of there's still a lot of work to be done.
Right.
And now that I'm old enough to actually understand what various words mean, which I was 11 years old in 2002, and it's been hard for a lot of, like, Catholics my age who, you know, our parents mostly shielded us from the first time around, and now we have to confront it, and especially being a millennial, and we're not a very religious bunch among my generation, and having to justify that already, and then having all these other stories comes out, it's very hard. But, I mean, I've found that the best approach with my friends who are considering joining the faith or in the process of being received into the church is to be just very frank with them and be like, we recognize that it's a problem. Here are very good bishops that I think are doing the right thing, and they hopefully outnumber the bad ones that are willing to just sit on their hands and let things happen. And I think current cultural trends are empowering survivors to come forward, and sunlight is the best disinfectant, even though it's going to be a very painful process.
I agree. Have you been surprised by anything here?
I think I've been surprised by... I mean, this is my first Fall General Assembly that I've attended. I feel like I should clarify that. I've been working in Catholic media since January, so I'm still pretty new.
So you're getting your feet wet.
Baptism by fire kind of sense. I've been surprised by I was surprised yesterday during the afternoon session by how it seemed more very, like, gloves-off kind of feel about it. We're like... A lot of bishops weren't afraid to just be like, no, here's what I believe on X, Y, and Z. And it seemed like lines are being drawn. And it's very interesting to see what kind of factions are being developed amongst the conference.
Yeah. Would you characterize those? So it seemed to me there was this idea of a metropolitan solution. That was one theme yesterday mm-hmm. afternoon. There was we have to candle the McCarrick investigation. There was the more evangelical theme, which said we need to make sure the gospel dominates what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to do catechesis. There was the fraternal correction theme.
I think that, like, all of them have their pluses and minuses.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to just kind of throw all of those in a pot and call it good. Like, I mean, like, I think all of those concerns are very necessary, and from the bishops that I've spoken to, they're extremely frustrated that, like, why is the Vatican taking so long? I spoke to Bishop Strickland on Monday from Tyler, Texas, and he pointed out, he's like, McCarrick is an American. All of his entire priesthood career happened in the United States. We have records. Those things are available. Why aren't we investigating them? We can help Rome out. Like, I don't know if they need some kind of authority to, like, actually do the investigation, but, like...
They do.
In
order to command... In order to enforce disclosure, they need Vatican approval.
Okay, like I said, joked earlier, my bosses are the canon lawyers. I'm not nearly an expert as they are, but... I can imagine it being extremely frustrating from an American bishop's point of view, of knowing how our justice system works and how we have these... you know, things already in place at least in the secular realm of how to investigate someone who's been accused of these historical crimes. Why aren't we doing it? And I think I think their anger is correct. Like, they want things done, and even before McCarrick passes away, because he is getting up there in age. I think also the Metropolitan, I thought that was very interesting. It would kind of give some more teeth to being that kind, like, in that position, which seems almost kind of like an extra title for... I mean, I know they do things, but, like, I think it'd be interesting to give them more power in that respect, because, like, in the United States, at least, we have these systems already in place to effectively do things.
I kind of put myself in the position of Archbishop Vigneron, and I said to myself, does he really want to go investigate? That's going to be a lot more work. But, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
It was at least a creative a meaningful approach.
Because I imagine they're just very frustrated. That's another theme I've really felt of this whole week is just extreme frustration. And because people want to get things done, and nothing is really honestly going to get done until, you know, we get the check mark of approval. And I think they're all very, very blindsided by Monday morning's announcement about the votes. And I think that kind of set the mood for the whole event within the first 10 minutes of its opening.
Yeah, I agree with you. Bishop Strickland was the first bishop to respond to the Vigano letter and echo his call for investigation. That was my first acquaintance with him when that happened. Mm-hmm. And I saw him for the first time yesterday in action, and I thought he was brilliant.
Yeah, I met him actually in 2017. My speaking back to our earlier thing of millennials becoming Catholic, my friend was received into the church in the Diocese of Tyler, and I was her confirmation sponsor, so I flew down, and that was my first experience with Bishop Strickland was back in Easter 2017. And we got reacquainted a month ago at another USCCB event, and then I emailed him to just talk about how you feel the investigation's going, and he was very frank with me, and he's like, I don't know if they're ever actually going to do an investigation, and there should be one.
Wow.
So...
By the way, frankness on the part of bishops is a fairly new thing, it seems to me.
So I mean, it's refreshing, at least.
Yes, that's what
I'm
saying.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to hear that he was that straightforward with you. We've got just about a minute left here. You're a young woman, Catholic.
Yep.
Now you've got your hands into the media. I often say if you're doing reporting on the Catholic Church, you're often seeing the church with its pants down. And in this case, that's actually not a very good metaphor,
not the best,
is it?
No.
But how are you doing with it spiritually?
It's been an interesting ride over the last few months. I'm from New England. I'm not an expert on who former bishops. I had never even heard of McCarrick really until all the things happened in June. Because I was 15 years old when he retired from the Archdiocese of Washington. I lived in Maine at the time. I'm not following, the bishops of various metropolitan areas. But it's been a challenge. But I'm gladdened, I guess is the word, by some of the actions I've seen here amongst the individual bishops themselves, because they do seem like they're so tired of the status quo. They want to see things change. And I think hopefully they get the ability to actually do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's been a challenge, I'll admit that. But, I mean, my faith is still strong.
Yeah. Christine, thanks so much.
No, thank you for having me.
Great being with you. And I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thank you.
So, Christine Roussel, again, covers D.C. for the Catholic News Agency. I'm Al Cresta.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to wreck?
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are committed.
As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Recently, a 3-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit unanimously ruled that King County's rejection of our client's Faces of Global Terrorism ad violated the First Amendment. The ad included the faces of 16 terrorists found on the FBI's Most Wanted Global Terrorist list, which is posted on the FBI's website. King County, which is located in Seattle, Washington, rejected our client's ad, claiming that the ad was demeaning and disparaging toward Muslims, since all of the listed terrorists, you guessed it, were Muslims. At the time, the FBI's Most Wanted Terrorist list included pictures and wanted posters for 32 terrorists. Of the 32 listed terrorists, 30 were individuals with Muslim names or were wanted for terrorism related to organizations conducting terrorist acts in the name of Islam. In its ruling, the Ninth Circuit held that the county's rejection of the ad based on its disparagement standard was viewpoint discrimination, and that its rejection of the ad based on its disruption standard was unreasonable, all in violation of the First Amendment. Make no mistake, this is an important victory for free speech. Too often we are seeing government officials restricting speech based on claims that is demeaning, disparaging, or offensive. The First Amendment does not allow such censorship, as the Ninth Circuit's opinion makes clear. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
The following is underwritten by a nonprofit organization.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the first Healing the Breach of Trust Conference, November 19th at our nation's capital. Engage with national religion reporters and Catholic leaders for a discussion about the role of media in investigating, reporting, and framing the public's understanding of the sexual abuse crisis in the church. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
Activate Life, LLC, is a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and independent distributor of Link. Link is an all-natural supplement that increases metabolism, improves brain function, restores gut health, regulates the immune system, and benefits the skin by providing critical energy to the brain and body on the cellular level. More information is available at ActivateGut.com. That's ActivateGut.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Are you fed up with the current healthcare system, paying too much for your healthcare cost? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. Visit SolidarityHealthShare.org to join like-minded Catholics in sharing medical expenses.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Well, we still don't know the motivation for the Holy See's insistence that the bishops delay policy action on the sex abuse matter. My guest, Edward Penton, is the Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register, and he's been really beating this down. He wants to help us understand what's happening here. Ed, good to have you with me.
Hi, good to be with you again, though.
I know you're working hard on this. What kind of cooperation are you getting from the various Vatican offices?
Well, this is the interesting aspect to this, Al, because I tried to get comments from, as one does, the Holy See press office about this, and five other dicasteries. But none of them didn't even reply. I mean, none of them replied, apart from Cardinal Ouellette, who gave a very short just saying that this Vatican decision was done because it's in the best interest, or it's the best way of assessing and accompanying the American bishops these questions, and that was about it. So there was very little to say about it, which is quite unusual. Usually they want to explain why they make such an important decision, but there was no effort to do so.
Interesting. I mean, I think those of us who have been watching this wonder, what was the harm in allowing the U.S. bishops to formulate policy? It's not as though the Vatican doesn't have any authority over it. I mean, if it was found to be flawed, the Holy See could have corrected the U.S. policy, right? And so it wasn't as though there any damage was going to be done that I can see. Maybe you're aware of a problem that might have eventuated from the bishops forming policy here, but it seemed to me these policies are all revisable and yes, submitted to the Holy See anyways, right?
That's right. And I mean, it's often the case. I mean, these issues on sexual abuse have been delegated to bishops' conferences to deal with, because the local church is obviously best in the best place to deal with this. So it is unusual, and there are various theories about why they wanted to do this, the Vatican, and I think one of them going round is that they're concerned about what any investigation that the U.S. bishops might conduct might lead to uncovering misconduct, perhaps cover-ups in the Vatican. I mean, that's just theoretical and speculative, but
sure.
But it's hard to see why they would do this unless there's some concern about this. Now, of course, this is to encourage collegiality and far better, as they say, to do this as the Congregation for Bishops said, to do this in the context of global Episcopal conferences around the world, and to do that in February, at this big meeting in February where all the bishops will meet from around the world to discuss this issue. So there is that argument as well, but you've got the French bishops meeting this week, although they met last week and decided to form a commission on sexual abuse and how to take that forward. And the Italian bishops are expected to produce guidelines this week that may not be made public. But they're not being given the same sort of sanction that the American bishops are. So there's a sort of one rule for the American bishops and another French and Italians, and that seems rather inconsistent too. So there's lots of questions being raised about this whole decision.
My guest is Edward Penton, who's Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register. How are the American bishops? What's the scuttlebutt about the American bishops? You know, when European bishops get around and talk, how do they regard the American episcopacy? Is it regarded as having certain characteristics that are favorable or unfavorable?
Well, I think one of the defining characteristics which distinguishes the American bishops from the European ones is the culture wars. And I think things don't have that same sort of sense of battling the culture wars that the American bishops have had. And I think they find it hard to identify with that, and they think it's perhaps either seen as extremist or selective or just, you know, it's not for some people it's not Catholic, which is surprising also for some people. But that's how it's often seen in Europe, especially in Italy, by quite a few people, quite a few of the faithful and the hierarchy here. So there is that distinguishing feature, and I think this is why. The American bishops are seen quite differently to other bishops. And and I think certainly the Pope seems to have a view, as we saw in Archbishop Vigano's testimony. He didn't want any more bishops who were sort of culture warriors. He wanted what he calls moderate bishops. I think maybe also behind this as well, I think there is this sense that the American bishops, because they are willing to fight the culture wars, that in a sense that puts them out of sync with the current pontificate, which does not want to do that. And I think that's another element to this whole issue as well.
I mean, is that because in countries like Italy and Germany, the church is so easily, is so comfortable with the national ethos there that they can't have a culture war because they're already so accommodated to the way things are?
Yes, and I think that's true. And I think it's also to do with the political systems here. And just to take the abortion issue as an example, I think it's always been passed through legislation here in Europe, I think in most countries, if not all, whereas, of course, in the U.S. it was more of a judicial decision sort of imposed from above and not really given put to the vote. So it's another element to this, in why they don't see those issues as quite such battle as you do in America, mm-hmm. And I think all these differences sort of play into this this inability, I think, to understand the situation in the U.S. But also the approach to sexual abuse. I think in Italy, it's not considered it's considered obviously very bad, but it's not to the same extent, I think, as it is in the United States. I don't think it's the anger that they feel. It's not been as prevalent here, or at least it hasn't been shown to be prevalent. And so there isn't that sense of urgency and anger that you get in the United States about this. And I think that's the same in quite a few countries outside the U.S. Among bishops in those countries. I think there's that sense of that they don't quite identify with the anger that's felt in the U.S., or they don't quite recognize it.
Right. I would assume, though, that at least pedophilia, you know, abuse of prepubescent children, is still a taboo that's recognized everywhere. Am I wrong?
No, it's still recognized and it's still considered obviously very serious, but I think there's not the, it's not to the same extent, I would say, as it is in the United States.
Okay.
I think there's still an outrage about it, but they don't seem to get quite as, and I think because I probably don't feel it's as widespread as it seems in the US, which I think is a false
right.
a false reading, because I think just because things haven't been revealed doesn't mean that they're not there. And
yeah.
and of course they're more prevalent in societies at large than in the church. So
mm-hmm.
so I think yeah, it I think that also is an element to this.
Let me ask you about
taking it less seriously.
Let me ask you about pederasty then. When you have an adult male who takes under his wing a post-pubescent adolescent, is that considered, even a minor, you know, is that considered in as much bad taste in Europe, in Italy, say, as it is in the United States?
It's hard to say. I think, again, issues aren't... they're not taken quite so they're taken seriously but not as seriously I think as in the United States, and that, for various cultural reasons, I think as I say, not to say that they're not taken seriously, but they are there's a sort of relative relativization of it in a sense.
Yeah.
I think more so here than in the US. But yeah, it's the same with the pedophilia, it's just a different approach.
Gotcha. Is Cardinal Supich regarded differently among Rome heads of dicasteries than he's regarded by many, much laity here, who see him as an ambitious cardinal who Monday was exceptional, where he jumped up immediately after Cardinal Donato's announcement, and obviously was prepared to make suggestions, basically take the wind out of, Cardinal Donato wasn't able to say much. Supich really took control of that situation. Is he regarded among Roman officials as ambitious, self-seeking?
I think it depends. It depends who you talk to. I think there's such... Things are divided now quite to such an extent along ideological lines that it depends who you talk to. Those who will be very much supportive of the current direction of the pontificate, I think, can have a problem with him. But those who have problems with the direction do. And I think it's almost a sort of benchmark, really, of where you stand on these issues, whether you support Cardinal Supich or not, and I think that's the same with the Vatican officials here. I have heard that Cardinal Supich is very very close to Pope Francis, and that he, if he wants to have an audience with him, he can get one, no problem. And I think he's regularly in contact with the Holy Father, so certainly the Cardinal Supich is seen as a close ally of the Pope, and very much in sync with this pontificate. That seems to be quite clear.
I'm going to float an idea by you, Edward, and I realize you're a reporter. So I understand your maybe reluctance to comment, but I want to throw it out there anyways, because you're there in Rome and you hear a lot. There's some fear here that what is happening is this, the engineering of a large resignation of American bishops, that this is on the horizon. And that with that resignation of a large number of American bishops, Pope Francis will be able to appoint bishops more in keeping with his agenda. And Cardinal Supich is a linchpin figure in this. Is there anything that you actually have seen there that would lend support or in some way falsify that scenario at this stage?
Any evidence that only the precedent, of course, of the Chilean bishops and then offering to resign en masse.
Okay.
I haven't seen any evidence that's going to happen. It could happen, but I think it's probably unlikely at the moment.
Okay, very good. Edward, thanks so much for your work. It's always good talking with you.
Thanks, good to be with you.
Edward Penton is the National Catholic Register's Rome correspondent. I'm Al Cresta.
The following is underwritten by a nonprofit organization.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the first Healing the Breach of Trust Conference November 19th at our nation's capital. Engage with national religion reporters and Catholic leaders for a discussion about the role of media in investigating, reporting, and framing the public's understanding of the sexual abuse crisis in the church. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com.
Activate Life, LLC, is a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and independent distributor of Link. Link is an all-natural supplement that increases metabolism, improves brain function, restores gut health, regulates the immune system, and benefits the skin by providing critical energy to the brain and body on the cellular level. More information is available at ActivateGut.com. That's ActivateGut.com.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruise, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's 2 coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net.
What are some of the common temptations against prayer? The Catechism claims that the most common yet hidden temptation is lack of faith, which is expressed not so much in a declaration of disbelief as our actual preferences. For instance, when we begin to pray, 1,000 labors or cares vie for priority. This is a moment of truth for our heart. What is our heart's true love? Do we call on the Lord just as a last resort? Or do we presumptuously call on him as an ally? In each case, the Catechism says, we have not acquired the disposition of the humble heart, which remembers the Lord's words, apart from me, you can do nothing. A presumptuous heart may experience the temptation of acidia, defined as spiritual depression due to lax ascetical practice, decreasing vigilance, and carelessness of heart. As Jesus chastised his sleeping apostles in Gethsemane, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
I've been a priest for 31 years. It's a call to a total gift to Christ. It's a total gift of one's life to be conformed to Christ. You know, and that's why I felt it when I was a young guy and I was kind of getting into religion and understanding it more deeply intellectually. It just began to hit me with a great clarity that if this is true, if God is real and God is a supreme good, well, why wouldn't I give my whole self to God? Why would I get distracted by anything else, you know? Now, again, I'm not saying that should be true for every single person on the planet. That's the way it hit me when I was a young guy, was I want to give as much as I can, my whole self, to Christ. So there's something heroic about that, where you do eschew a lot of things. You say no to a lot of things so you can say massively yes to Christ and to his demand. I think that's a heroic quality of it.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. We continue in Baltimore at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops annual fall session. With me right now is Danielle Brown, Associate Director for the Ad Hoc Committee Against Racism. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you.
We've been on pilgrimage together, so I was delighted to know you were here. The pastoral letter on racism was supposed to be the big event.
The main event.
For this thing, and then, of course, we had the McCarrick thing, and then Vigano. And I imagine that created some conversation in your department as to, well, how should we handle? Do we step down? Do we wait? What do we do with this pastoral letter? Because it's significant.
Right.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of conversations in that way. I think most of them happened far above my pay grade.
Okay.
And so I was more the recipient of whatever trickle down from those conversations. But there were thoughts towards, the timing of the letter coming But I think ultimately what was decided is that there were so many communities of color and so many communities within our ecumenical partners who were really waiting for this and knew that it was coming down the pipelines. And I think 2 to 3 years in the making it was for the USCCB to get the text finalized. And so it was seen particularly by the Committee on Cultural Diversity as a huge undertaking, because that's the committee that launched the process, and cultural diversity really pushed for it to move forward, despite the atmospheric situation.
Yeah, I mean, the sex abuse issue has sucked all the oxygen out of the room.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
But the bishops have published significant pastorals on racism before.
In the past, that's right. That's right.
So let's talk a little bit about this one.
Sure.
It will be. Is it released this today, tomorrow?
Well, and that's the hope. The bishop's body has gone into assembly just as we're speaking. And so the idea is that the vote will happen today or has already happened.
Yeah.
And will be finalized within hours, if not sooner, hopefully today or tomorrow posted.
Okay. What can you tell us about it?
Sure. So it was written in the model of a letter from St. Paul, and it really focuses on conveying the idea that...
I like that, by the way.
Right?
Whose idea was that?
I know. Brilliant.
In that format.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And so it's calling upon the community to really take a self-analysis, both clergy and laity, to look at not only themselves and at the spiritual state of their affairs when it comes to racism, but also structural systems of racism that they may be a part of.
Yeah, so this is addressing more than personal prejudice.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right, because I think that, again, the bishops want to revisit the idea that we've come quite a distance, but it's quite evident because of so many things that have happened in the last even year or two that we've got a lot of ground to cover.
So
that's where they are, and they review the ground that we still need to cover and sort of take a state of the nation, state of the church when it comes to race relations. Yeah. And then they ask people to apply what we know about each other as brothers and sisters and what we know about each other in terms of us being made in the image and likeness of God, every one of us, and to really apply that in a way that exhorts people to look beyond their normal racial segregation.
Sure, sure. What's your sense of the church in America, of the Catholic Church's record on race? In some places it looks good. Other places you say, what? Has nobody read the scriptures?
So
what's your overall sense?
Well, I mean, the Catholic Church in America is really interesting, particularly because, unlike our Protestant brothers and sisters, we never had a race-based split.
Right.
And so if you put the Catholic Church next to, you know, some of the mainline Protestant churches.
Yeah, Presbyterian split.
That's right.
Methodist
that's
split.
Right.
Baptist
that's
split.
That's exactly it.
North and South.
And so the thing that's been interesting for me, even before I came into this job about half a year ago, I had been watching the Protestant churches really reckon with this, you know, and in part because I had so many friends in an ecumenical community and spent a lot of time with an ecumenical community, and they were really grappling in their churches with the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it became apparent to me that they have been forced to grapple with these issues in a way that we have not. And so what...
In a way because their sin was more obvious.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, okay.
It always before them, even.
Yeah. Yeah. In their name.
That's exactly
Southern
it.
Baptist.
Right.
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 Yeah, yeah.
AME. You know, and so... There, if I could use the word shame, you know, I started listening about a year ago to a lot of Protestant preachers on YouTube talk about racism, and the thing that comes up that comes to mind is shame, and it was impressive to me to see their pastors in large part want to enter into the process of reconciliation and admit that they felt ashamed of it. And it's not to say that all Protestant churches have done this and done this well, but I think a lot of them have had to grapple with it, like I said, in a way that we haven't. So with respect to that, I think that the Catholic Church being so wide and massive, it's a miracle that we are as unified in the United States as we are, to be honest with you. I think that in itself is a miracle.
Yes, yeah.
But I think the church has done a poor job, if I can make a criticism, in the catechesis of communities of color. And I think about this quite a bit. You know, folks like you and Father John Ricardo, who are nationally known to a lot of people, aren't known to a lot of communities of color.
That's true.
And why is that?
That's a very good point.
And, yeah, I consume a lot of Catholic media. So whether it's Father Mike Smits or Sister Ann Shields or, you know, any of the big name Catholic speakers, and I wonder why my Black brothers and sisters have no idea in some places what theology of the body is. It's stunning to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in some sense, we're doing great because we're still standing in America and our churches have come a great distance in terms of staying open. And in that sense, I mean, physically open to parishioners coming in and out. However, I think the big problem right now is that there are unspoken barriers to people of color being fully integrated into communities, church communities, you know, and so whether it's you go to a parish and you're a person of color at a mainly white parish and nobody talks to you for weeks, months, and years, or you do consume a lot of Catholic media and you never see anybody who looks like you. And if you do, there's so few and far between that it's almost not worth mentioning that they even exist in the realm of Catholic media. And so there's a lot of work to be done in terms of bringing diverse voices into the conversation because something wrong happens in all of our brains when the only parties speaking the truth, presenting the truth, of the Holy Roman Catholic Church, they only look one way. They only look white. There's something wrong happens in all of our brains.
Especially in the Catholic Church, which prides itself on its Catholicity.
That's
and if you look at a World Youth Day, I mean, there's a riot of color and languages and even intergenerational
stuff going
on.
That's right.
And I like to point to that and I say, look at that. That's diversity there.
That's right.
But you're right. And I can even speak from personal experience on this. In Detroit, when I was broadcasting in Detroit, there was a lot of conversation dealing with race. When I moved to Ann Arbor, much less so.
Sure.
And, you know, I confess, at the beginning, because my own personal experience in Detroit, because of my personal interests in history of civil rights movement in America and the way there was an evangelical message in a number of civil rights leaders, I thought that was something to talk about. It didn't get any traction. So, frankly, I didn't spend much more time on it.
Sure.
I mean, you know. I had friends who kind of chastised me lovingly when this happened 15 years ago. But it's a problem, and it's a problem nationally, too, that theologically conservative Catholics in America, race is not very high on their list of priorities. It's not necessarily that there's any personal, you know, resistance. It's just that it just doesn't float to the top.
That's right.
Family issues do. And, of course, where they live, you know, they live largely with people who are like them.
That's right.
Birds of a feather flock together, that kind
of thing.
That's right. And it's even sometimes embarrassing to bring it up because people get defensive right away. So if you point this out, it's like, what, are you accusing me of something?
Right.
Well, no, not really. I'm just saying it's kind of funny, isn't it, that we don't talk about this when, in fact, in the last few years, it's been a lot of media discussion of it.
That's right.
You know, in cable news. So it's tough.
It is tough. And I think particularly you have to look at the effect of not talking about these things on our children. You know, everybody wants to talk about youth right now, which I think is brilliant. But, you know, in working on this for the USCCB, part of my job is to bring listening sessions on race to local dioceses so that their bishops, who may not have had the time or the inclination or really the catalyst to start thinking about these issues, to really make a placeholder in their brains for these issues and to give their congregations an opportunity to get in front of them and in effect, educate their bishops and educate, you know, their brothers and sisters who come and who are curious as to what they have to say. And we've done two of those, one in St. Louis and one in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I attended one in Brooklyn, and I was astounded by how many stories of people who were high school age, elementary school age, and these things have happened not too long ago, where it was just very clear that their teachers weren't ready to have a conversation. their friends weren't equipped to speak intelligently about race. And it all points to, it's not being talked about at home.
Right.
And race is an issue. Well, first of all, it's a social construction, but issues of racism are crucial to be discussed as a discussion topic around all the tables.
Yes. I agree with you. In America, it's an incredibly important topic. And you're right. It is a social construction. I mean, if you move outside the United States, in some places it's not that big an issue.
That's right.
Skin pigmentation is an issue. But in America, it's been charged with social significance.
That's right.
And so, yes, it is a social construction. But that doesn't mean it ain't nothing.
That's exactly it.
You still have to figure out, how do we address this? And it's a major part of American history. You look over the history of baseball. You look over the history of music.
That's right.
It's all part of our story. But it hasn't been well integrated. And so I think a lot of us are uncomfortable beginning the conversation because we don't want to look stupid.
And that's what everybody says. Or a lot of people, you know, you're less woke, quote unquote. I think the kids are saying woke these days.
Woke is the word, huh?
That's right. Okay. Really, are you woke? You know, are you awake to the issues of the day is what they're trying to convey when they say that. But there are people who are not from the communities of color that we traditionally talk about. There are white folks out there who oftentimes say, I'm just so scared I'll look stupid. And there's this fear that they're not willing to move beyond. And so, you know, I think that that's where the pastoral letter can really be helpful. Yeah. And I'm excited to get it out in front of people because it really is an enduring call to love others that we have to remember. And this thing about not feeling stupid, and I told my coworkers not too long ago that they have to understand that being Black in America, being Latino in America, being Asian, Pacific Islander, or Native American, being a minority, a person of color in America is hard. It's a cross that you have to carry. And the most important thing that folks who are worried about looking stupid and feeling uncomfortable have to realize is that when you're a minority in America, when you're a person of color in America, there is a level of discomfort that you experience a lot of times every day of your life.
Right.
And it would be an act of taking up this cross alongside of communities of color and people of color if white folks, people of European descent, people who identify as white would check that for a moment. Just check it at the door for a moment and come alongside of us and realize that you're just entering into a discomfort that a lot of us experience every day of our lives.
Well said. Well said. We'll talk again.
Sounds good.
Yeah,
this is
really good, Danielle. Good to see you again.
You.
I'm glad
good
you got a hold
you
of me.
Too. So, yeah, praise God. Thanks.
Again, Danielle Brown, working with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, where she is Associate Director of the Ad Hoc Committee Against Racism. I'm Al Cresta.
It's time to take control of your healthcare journey and experience healthcare fully alive with CMF Curo. Krista and Justin say,
we love having the understanding, decision-making, and control of our healthcare in our own hands and having the option to bear one another's burdens. But most importantly, we love helping others when they need medical support.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry that values the health of the whole person, spirit, mind, and body.
To experience healthcare fully alive for you and your family, visit mycatholichealthcare.com.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruz, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's 2 coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
We just did our parish mission a couple weeks ago now, and I suggested that in the course of the mission that we do something like a little mini spiritual assessment of our lives. I don't have to show this to anybody, but a great chance for us just to, with real honesty, just between us and Jesus, ask ourselves some questions. First question, given the fact that half of Catholics don't think God is even personal, would be to ask ourselves that. Do I think God is personal? And then to ask myself, do I think a relationship with Jesus is possible? Do I have a relationship with Jesus? And if so, what's it look like? And then perhaps a little bit more awkwardly or painfully, to ask Jesus, from his perspective, what's the friendship that we have with him look like? How would he describe our friendship with him? That might be a hard conversation to have.
I'm Al Cresta. We're here in Baltimore continuing. Let me say thanks for being with me this hour. We got another hour coming up. I hope you'll be joining us there. Teresa Tomeo joins us from Rome. Janet Smith joins us about the, again, a lay-driven organization coming into existence, No More Victims, as again, one area's solution to this problem. And we'll also be joined by Matthew Bunsen, who will tell us what happened with the new slate of committee chairs for the USCCB. There was an election taken earlier today. But you can follow up on any of our conversations from this hour by going to the Ave Maria website, avemariaradio.net. Go to the Cresta Guest Archives. We'll also have the we'll have information on the pastoral letter. Hopefully we'll have the pastoral letter there on racism that Danielle Brown referred to, and which was supposed to be the big event for this fall session. We'll have further information on all the topics that we've been discussing, articles by Christine Roussel in the National Catholic Register from Catholic News Agency, Edward Penton's reporting from Rome, which has been significant. So get on over to AveMariaRadio.net for more information in the Cresta Guest Archive, and stay with me, another hour coming up.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We're here in Baltimore, Maryland, and we are, in fact, enjoying the annual bishops' meeting for the fall. There's a number of mysterious things happening, just that are a little bit unpredictable. We're going to talk those over in the first segment of this hour's program with Dr. Matthew Bunsen. A recent vote that was taken there that I have to say is a little surprising. We're also going to spend time today talking with Teresa Tomeo, who's in Rome, giving us some sense of what she's hearing there. Because, again, as you probably understand from previous conversations, the United States, from last hour, is looked at, the U.S. bishops are looked at differently in Europe than we look at them here. Ed Penton mentioned it last hour as well. So Teresa will tell us what she'll be hearing. And then Janet Smith will be joining us to talk about this ongoing problem. Even if the incidents of abuse have diminished significantly, what we have is still an unresolved question of why this happened. And what is it about our ecclesial and episcopal culture that was so easily abused and so that predators were protected? We'll be talking that over again with Janet Smith. She and myself have worked together, along with Jason Negri and a number of others, to organize a group called No More Victims, which we'll tell you a little bit about when Janet joins us. She's taken this year off, it's a leave of absence for her, to begin helping build reform And we'll tell you again about this new organization. So that's coming up in this hour, Crest, in the afternoon, so stay with me. But right now, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, November 14th. It's the Feast of St. Alberic of Utrecht. Today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, serving pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. Victims of California's campfire are suing the power company believed to be responsible for the blaze. Allegations against PG&E claim the company failed to properly maintain its equipment and infrastructure, which resulted in the start of the fire that has killed at least 48 people and destroyed thousands of buildings. The U.S. Border Patrol is busy as the first wave of migrants from the Central American caravan arrives along the border with Mexico in San Diego County. Some migrants were seen scaling fences while others climbed through openings, only to run back when agents approach. Many of the migrants traveling with the caravan composed of nearly 5,000 people that originated in Honduras. The incoming chairman of the House Investigating Committee says even Trump country wants accountability.
If you look at the results of this election, they're saying, while we like Trump, some people saying we like him, we like what he's doing, we want the Congress to make him accountable.
Maryland Democrat Representative Elijah Cummings will take over the gavel of the House Oversight and Government Reforms Committee. He pledges to be judicious with issuing subpoenas during investigations. CNN is getting support from Fox News and other news media companies in its legal battle with the White House. So-called amicus briefs are being filed in the fight over suspension of CNN correspondent Jim Acosta's White House media credential. CNN is demanding that Acosta's credential be restored immediately. The White House accused Acosta of inappropriate conduct during a presidential news conference last week. And the U.S. Postal Service is reporting nearly $4 billion in losses for 2018, despite delivering more packages this year. Shipping and package sales rose 10%, while first-class mail declined by about 4% as a part of an overall drop in mail volume. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta here in Baltimore, Maryland, where we are looking at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops annual fall session. With me right now, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, who's been with us every day this week, and it's good to see you again.
It is.
Well, let's talk about today's activity. I've talked to a few bishops who say that there's been a little more passion than they're accustomed to in these meetings. People are speaking a little more from the heart. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, given what you've seen in the past?
I would. I think what we have seen over the last few days, the shocking events on Monday notwithstanding, yeah. In a way, the shocking events on Monday in some ways gave a certain freedom to the bishops,
yes,
to speak even more freely.
I think that's right. Yep.
In a couple of different ways. I think a number of bishops have expressed their frustration, disappointment, anger even, at the decision on the part of the Holy See. But we've also heard from a number of bishops, I think, who feel even more free to express their concerns, not just their disappointment with the Holy See, but also a recognition of how hurt their faithful are.
Yeah.
And how damaged, I think, the credibility of a lot of the bishops could be at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. In spite of that, there was a resolution that, well, why don't you set it up, because you have the language.
Well, the resolution itself was proposed on yesterday morning, almost immediately after the start of the session. And I can read you the actual text that was being proposed. Now, there was a shorter version of this, and then they had a number of amendments. So I'll just read this, if it's okay.
Yeah, please.
The amendment, the proposal was, recognizing the ongoing investigation of the Holy See into the case of Archbishop McCarrick, be it resolved that the bishops of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops encourage the Holy See to release soon all the documentation that can be released consistent with canon and civil law regarding the allegations of misconduct against Archbishop McCarrick. A shorter first version was proposed to the bishops. It didn't include a couple of items, including the word soon, also the regarding allegations of misconduct. The original text said regarding the misconduct of Archbishop McCarrick. So there were a number of amendments from the floor that were accepted. Bishop Boyer of Lansing was the architect, the drafter of this resolution.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of back and forth. Opposition to this proposal, this amendment and everything else about it, began with Cardinal Tobin of Newark.
All right. That sounds like a fairly innocent resolution. It asks for information that should have been forthcoming, but it just says we're here. We want you to know we're still here. We're still awaiting this information.
Yes. Cardinal Tobin's argument against the resolution was that something like this had already been pledged by the Holy See. This goes back to October 6th, when the Holy See, that Pope Francis had initiated a documentary search, a documentary investigation into the McCarrick affair. Now, the complication there, as was noted by a number of bishops, is that we actually have perhaps five different investigations going on.
Right.
We have the four involving the Archdiocese and Diocese of Newark, of yep. New York, of Washington, of Metuchen, and then we have the investigation on the Holy See side.
Yeah, we've got the Seton Hall investigation.
Precisely.
Based on Title IX, yeah.
So, but in specific to McCarrick, we have all of those investigations going on. So I think one of the things that this proposal was attempting to get at was to just give this encouragement that let's see everything. And Cardinal Tobin objected to that idea on the basis, as I said, that the Holy See has already pledged to do this. Further objections were raised by Cardinal Supich of Chicago that, again, this is simply reiterating what the Holy See has already pledged to do. Other bishops came forward and argued along similar lines, but one or two of them actually made the case that, well, there seems to be a kind of mistrust undergirding this proposal, that somehow we do not expect a full and forthright release of documentation on the part of the Holy See. As you note, it does seem to be a fairly straightforward type of an appeal to the Holy See.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that one could find in this particular resolution that would imply that anyone on the part of the Holy See is actually either mendacious or lying.
Right.
Or that they would withhold vital information.
You know, it's just weird.
It's an important snapshot. If day one was a shock that the proposals are not being advanced to a vote, and day two was a response that we need to have this discussion about the different proposals, day three, it strikes me, has largely been dominated by the figure of Theodore McCarrick. We've had a number of interventions by bishops, Bishop Olson being one of them, asking, would former Cardinal McCarrick be welcome here as a bishop emeritus?
Did they vote on that?
No.
Okay.
But his point was that as somebody who is under allegations, under accusation of misconduct of a stunning variety,
right,
he still technically belongs to the conference.
Yeah, that's right.
And that were he to come up and ask to speak to this body, would he be allowed? And the damage done to the body of bishops here, to the conference, to the reputation of the church in the United States, to the credibility of the bishops by McCarrick, is overhanging this entire day.
Yeah.
And this resolution, I think, was intended at least to be a step forward in trying to remedy, I don't want to put it in crass public relations terms, but the damage that's been done, both in terms of the optics, but also the spiritual and social cultural credibility of the USCCB and the bishops as a whole. And it is a striking statement that the bishops gathered here, all of them fully aware of the dimensions of this crisis, could not come together to pass a resolution that seems to many very straightforward. It lost, I think, by a total, 85 to 137. So 137 bishops voted against this resolution.
Wow. I'm actually trying to figure out, how to assess this and what this means in light of my picture of what was going on here. I would have thought, in light of all that I heard yesterday and what I was hearing about today, because I wasn't on the floor today, I would have thought that this was almost pro forma, given there was a lot of for the bishops, anyways, a lot of passion shown yesterday, I thought, that they'd been out on listening tours and their people wanted to know how this had happened, with McCarrick, and that it was not a right or left thing, a conservative liberal thing. It went across the spectrum. And I would have thought this would be a way for the bishops to just say, we want accountability, so we want to make sure this information is going to be released publicly. I don't see what the damage would have done, Ben. Is the Holy Father so insecure that had he received something like that, he'd say, those bullies, what are they trying to do? No, that's not going to happen.
No.
So what's the potential
damage? Strikes me
damage?
As unlikely that that...
What's the potential damage of sending a resolution like this?
Well, I just mentioned that I think Archbishop McCarrick is a shadow on this gathering here. But there's also something else at work, too, and that is the impulse to try to drive the investigation, a fully transparent investigation, to deal with this crisis, especially about McCarrick, because at the end of the day, the grand jury report in Pennsylvania, that you and I have talked, is a largely historical document. Terrible.
Yes.
But McCarrick is the ground zero of this current crisis.
That's
so
right.
There is this impulse to do that. There's another impulse, and that is there a level of mistrust about Pope Francis? Is there concern about transparency in how this investigation is going forward? We have seen a lot of hesitation. There have been delays. There has not been, in the view of a lot of people, critics, much progress in this. And in a way, Bishop Olson of Fort Worth came forward today. He made that strong statement about Theodore McCarrick. But he also made the observation that we have to be careful, I'm paraphrasing, that we defend Pope Francis, that we do not do things that would appear to be out of unity with him. So I think one of the things that we're seeing here, and we have seen developing in the last few months, in particular after the release of the letter by Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, that in some quarters there has been concern that the attacks on Pope Francis are a danger to the unity in the church.
Gotcha.
And I think that is an impulse that we're seeing here.
Yes.
And it is a concern on the part of a number of bishops.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the things that undergirds much of what we have just seen today. So
we are the non-veganos, right?
I mean, yes.
They want to make sure that they're distanced. In fact, I talked to Bishop Strickland of Tyler, Texas, who was the first bishop to call, not for resignation of Pope Francis, not at all, but call for an investigation.
Yes.
And he seemed to go to great lengths to want to reassure me and anybody else that he wasn't calling for resignation, which I thought was always clear.
Yes,
you know,
right.
I didn't need to be convinced of that because we had the same thing. We called for an investigation, and we had no intention of calling for Pope Francis' resignation. I didn't know enough to do that. If Vigano thinks he knows enough, that's fine for him to do it, but I'm not following. I just want an investigation.
And I know very, very few people that I've talked to who are ardent supporters of Archbishop Vigano who are also calling for the resignation of Pope Francis.
Yeah.
Rather, they simply want his, what I think we can all agree, are credible allegations regarding how Theodore McCarrick came to power, how he stayed there. That needs an investigation. So there has been, a dichotomy, a choice, a false choice in many ways that has emerged.
Wow.
And we're seeing, I think, some of that play out here on the floor of the USCCB.
That actually makes sense of this. So somebody, Tobin, Supich, both who are recent appointments by Pope Francis, they basically are circling the wagons around the Holy Father. And they're saying, look, we want to make sure no negative information about him can possibly be attributed to us. So we don't need to call on him to release these things. He said he's going to do it. And if you push him on this, you're going to look like somehow you're in the Vigano camp or something.
I think there's a certain aspect to that.
Yeah,
I really do, watching the dynamic play out here today. And one or two bishops... actually made the comment that it looks as though we're not trusting the Holy See. I said that a little while ago. And that is a perception, I think, that a lot of bishops want to avoid, that we're taking what is already a terrible situation and potentially making it worse by implying that somehow we cannot trust Pope Francis.
Wow. Well, I don't see how that follows, but
yes, I
that's their perception.
I understand
of
your thinking, too.
Yeah. Well, let me thank you again. We'll talk. We'll follow up. When this plays out a little bit, we'll get back together again.
Absolutely.
And compare notes, because there's some other people I want to talk to. But, Matthew, thank you so much.
It's been a privilege to be here this week with you.
Great being with you. I'm Al Cresta.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Here's the new challenge. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament, with the goal of an hour a day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I had a guy come up to me and he says, Father, you know, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm in a men's fellowship. I pray with my wife every day. I go to Mass every Sunday and usually a couple times during the week. I read scripture. He goes, I want more. I said, do you pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament? He said, outside of Mass, no. I said, I think that's the more. See, all these saints, these are the ones who surround us. These are the ones who ran before us. These are the ones who fought well, who kept the faith. They would tell you, as would every single saint in heaven right now, you cannot run this race if you don't spend time with the Master. Whatever else we're doing, it's second, third, and fourth. First things need to be first. And the first thing is to be with the Master, and the Master is Jesus.
Debates about God's existence are all the rage today. But what about the soul? When was the last time you heard of a debate about the immortality of the soul? How can we know that the soul is immortal, and not just a few pounds of electric meat that produces cool experiences between our ears like a mythical god? Very few modern thinkers are devoting a lot of time today to the question of the soul and whether it's immortal. Plato thought so, as did most Greek philosophers. Certainly the Bible affirms it. Dr. Michael Agros has written a new book called The Immortal in You: How Human Nature is More Than Science Can Say. I recommend highly you check out my interview with him on my podcast. You'll learn a ton, as I did, about your body-soul nature, which was made by God, who is love, destined for heaven, and in peril of hell. This is Patrick Coffin at patrickcoffin.media. Be a saint. What else is there?
The following is underwritten by a nonprofit organization.
The Catholic University of America and the Institute for Human Ecology invite you to join the first Healing the Breach of Trust Conference, November 19th at our nation's capital. Engage with national religion reporters and Catholic leaders for a discussion about the role of media in investigating, reporting, and framing the public's understanding of the sexual abuse crisis in the church. For more information on how to register or access the event via live stream, visit healingthebreach.org.
Activate Life, LLC, is a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and independent distributor of Link. Link is an all-natural supplement that increases metabolism, improves brain function, restores gut health, regulates the immune system, and benefits the skin by providing critical energy to the brain and body on the cellular level. More information is available at ActivateGut.com. That's ActivateGut.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical, and in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
It's time to take control of your healthcare journey and experience healthcare fully alive with CMF Curo. Krista and Justin say,
we love having the understanding, decision-making, and control of our healthcare in our own hands and having the option to bear one another's burdens. But most importantly, we love helping others when they need medical support.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry that values the health of the whole person, spirit, mind, and body.
To experience healthcare fully alive for you and your family, visit mycatholichealthcare.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We are here in Baltimore, Maryland, at the annual fall session of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Been interviewing, again, many of those who are covering the case here, been discussing with bishops. And also we talked with Edward Penton from Rome, and also Teresa Tomeo today joins us from Rome. Teresa, you know well, of course, is the host of Catholic Connection. And Teresa, it's good to have you with me.
Hey, I'll be here in Roma.
The eternal city. Yeah. I was anxious to talk to you. I'm just wondering what you're hearing in Rome about this, about the bishops here in the United States and what's going on, and the Pope's intervention at least the Holy See's intervention at the beginning of the week. How's it playing there?
Well, it's interesting because we've had three different priests with us for our spiritual direction. We've been in eight cities in 7 days with nearly 30 women from around the country, and so most of the information we're gathering, in addition to talking to contacts here, of course, Joan Lewis is from EW10, has been with us part of the time, so she's been up to date on the story. And then I've been following it, of course, online. But it's really interesting to talk to the priests who are studying here. We've had contact, as I said, to our direct pilgrimage, helping us with the masses and whatnot. Three different priests from three different areas of the country, all either living and working here permanently or temporarily studying. And I guess the best word I could use is confusion. Yeah. They're confused. They're also somewhat disillusioned, and they really just want to keep their heads down, keep studying, get their advanced degrees, and get home so they can really evangelize. But it's very frustrating because they're concerned. I mean, they want to unleash the gospel, as our Archbishop says, and they seem to be getting different messages as we all are seeing this. And so it's really hard, but at the same time, they're very Orthodox men, and they're very determined to make a difference in the faith. And they said, you know, the Church has been through more confusing times than this, and they say we're in Rome with all these great relics of some of the greatest saints, including St. Catherine of Siena, where I prayed this morning for about a half an hour after the pilgrims left. So I think confusion and a little bit of disillusionment is what people are talking about.
Yeah, and understandably, the action of the Holy See on Monday morning, or at least it was made known to us on Monday morning, to instruct the American bishops not to come up with policy was a real shocker. Shocker on a number of grounds. First of all, that it was done at the last minute like this, a very sloppy and erratic way of running an organization. Secondly, I don't know what the benefit was, because whatever the U.S. bishops would come up with would be subject to the Holy See's conclusion anyways. You know what I'm saying? So they could have done it and revised it.
I think that's what everybody's wondering about, why. I mean, and it's not as if, as the articles on the National Catholic Register and EWTN News have been reporting, and Catholic News Agency, it's not as if Rome didn't know they were talking about this week. I mean, Cardinal DiNardo has reached out numerous times, and when he came here to Rome earlier this summer, that was shut down pretty quickly in terms of the investigation that he was looking for. So that's the answer. Why? The big question is why? What's the benefit? Because what this does is just gets the laity, and I know I can just tell you, we've been posting articles on my Facebook page, keeping up on the news, and my Facebook page has been exploding. The people are saying this is just so frustrating, and yes, we have to pray harder, but at the same time, they're saying people have to speak up more strongly than they have over the past few months.
Yes, indeed, laity need to be speaking. And I should say that the bishops are aware of the complaints of the laity. I sat and listened to bishop after bishop yesterday afternoon approach the microphone, and it's interesting. There were different perspectives, but there's no doubt that many bishops believe that greater involvement of the laity is part of the solution here. Bishop Boyer, for instance, who spent most of his time discussing this, what they're calling the metropolitan solution, that maybe archbishops can be empowered to hold accountable the suffragan bishops on matters like this. While he went and made some suggestions along those lines, he also pointed out at the end that, look, whatever we do has to include the laity. So this is coming up over and over again. Bishop Barron, same thing, saying, you know, the laity have to be included here. And I can't tell you how many bishops I heard say that in their listening sessions, the name of McCarrick kept coming up over and over and over again, and how many of the lay faithful were absolutely flabbergasted that he continued to climb the hierarchical ladder in spite of what was known of his behavior. So there were quite a few good things said from bishops. There were a few bishops who seemed not to understand the urgency of the problem. Most notably, in my estimation, was Bishop Wensky of Miami, who basically said that the life of the church is moving on, and so, you know, stop watching the blogs and stop watching cable TV, and, you know, you won't have any problem. You won't, if you stop doing that, you won't be so outraged, so which I thought was just terrible. But that's what he said.
Yeah. Well, I think the one thing that is causing the lady to do, and this was expressed with the pilgrims on our trip, and we had nearly 30 women from all across the country, many of whom were involved in some pretty big ministries in their home dioceses, is that this is forcing all of us to do what we're supposed to do in the first place, is to keep our eyes really closely fixed on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And and I've found myself clinging even more closely to the saints. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned, St. Catherine of Siena has always been one of my favorites. We had Mass at the chapel at St. Dominic's in Siena earlier this week. And then this morning, the first thing I did when I got up is I went over to Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, which is where her tomb is. And, you know, she has her head in Siena and her torso is down here in Rome. And so you have the opportunities in several different places in Italy to pray before her relics. But I just sat there and did the readings and just prayed and said, help, Santa Caterina, you know, help us get through this. And you've seen much worse. And so it is, I think, causing us to focus on the big picture of the church. But something has got to be done, because there was also a great deal of frustration and people not giving up and not being hopeless, but also at the same time saying this has just gone on, you know, far too long, and now we're waiting until February until this is really going to be addressed. And why wouldn't you want the bishops to have something concrete to review in February? I mean, you have work that's already done that can be looked at. So why delay it? If you're really concerned about this issue and if you're trying to listen to the people, and I know, and you and I know many of the bishops, as you said, were going into this very hopeful that they could come up with something
concrete,
and they were really determined to look at it.
In fact, Archbishop Sample of Portland talked about this as a watershed moment. How the shepherds respond, how we respond to this moment is going to determine the future of the church in America. And he, again, like Bishop McKnight of Jefferson City, and I'm trying to think who else, Bishop Strickland of Tyler, Texas, and others, they were very big on reminding the bishops of their primary task, which is as proclaimers of the gospel. I think it was Archbishop Sample who said that he was on the catechism committee, the subcommittee on catechism, and he said, look, it's apparent to all of us on that committee that there are vast numbers of American Catholics who have no idea what the faith is. They haven't been catechized.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed too, so this is worth pointing out, that the younger bishops, generally speaking, the younger bishops were the ones who seemed to have a more vigorous spiritual solution in mind. In other words, that we needed to get back to the proclamation of the gospel. They weren't ignoring other type solutions, like, you know, maybe some sort of lay tribunal board, maybe this metropolitan solution. But they were very specific. It was obvious they were committed to not discussing this apart from the gospel and the work of the Holy Spirit. In fact, there was one bishop, an older bishop, who got up and said, you know, I've been listening here for an hour, and I haven't heard anybody mention the Holy Spirit or Jesus. And I think these younger bishops were aware of that, and they made sure that they were not going to ignore some of the basic elements of our faith. So I would say, if there's one thing I would immediately say we should take heart in, it's these younger bishops, who I hope will be with us a long time, because they were singing the song I like to dance to. So, yeah.
I also think, too, that these priests, these dedicated priests, there's so many of them, especially the young ones from the new evangelization, the ones that we met with this week here in Rome. And you know, I have many friends here who are studying in Rome, and in addition to the priests that were with us on the trip to help us out with the daily masses. They're disillusioned, they're confused, at the same time they're determined, they're more determined than ever, and they see the need for the new evangelization, and they just want to get down to the business of evangelizing and witnessing and helping people embrace the faith.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I always pray about this: is why is this happening? I mean, God has a plan, and His plans, as it says in Isaiah, are so much higher than ours. But I think it's really causing us to say, okay, do we really believe? Is it true? This is what Father John Ricardo said to me years ago when Dominic and I were being persecuted in the church, and he said, is it true? And I said, is what true? And he said, is everything that you talk about on the radio, is everything that you write in your books, is it true? And I said, well, of course it's true. He says, well, he said, you got to keep going and keep pushing forward. And I think that's the lesson in the end here.
Right.
But we don't let this go. We have to make sure that we are respectfully keeping the pressure on, because people are not taking this lightly. I mean, we were with all kinds of people all week long from all over the country, and then again meeting with priests from all over the country, you know, several of whom were on the trip, several friends of ours here in Rome. People are confused, they're disillusioned, but they're not giving up on the church. And in many ways, it's making them more determined.
No, I agree. I think one of the most amazing things to me is how these events, beginning in June, have galvanized the engaged laity like I've never seen before. It's been an incredibly uniform response. People saying, yeah, we're angry, yeah, we're disgusted, but we're not going anywhere. We're taking co-responsibility for the church. We're going to go. We're going to exhort. We're going to admonish. We're not going anywhere. The church is too important to leave to clergy alone. So, I'm feeling, you know, this is going to. I don't know how long this suffering is going to go on, but I do think that in the long run, it will all work together for good. But that won't be the case if you don't hang in there. So.
That's right. That's right. And that's one of the reasons why we take pilgrimages and why we spend time in these beautiful churches and venerating the relics of the saints, to remember that that's what it's all about. In the end, it's about Jesus and evangelizing people. So,
how do people stay in touch with you, Teresa?
And just on my website, teresatomio.com.
Okay. We'll do that. Thanks so much for talking with me there in Rome.
Okay. I'll see you soon. God bless.
Teresatomio.com. I'm Al Cresta.
Hey, this is Chris Stefanik. Choosing the right college is one of the most important decisions in your child's life. Unfortunately, many young people find themselves at universities where their faith is disparaged, truth is rejected, and reason is forgotten. Franciscan University of Steubenville is different. It's a place where students and faculty are passionate about their Catholic faith, truth is sought after, and academic excellence is the standard. As a dad and alum, it's the only school I'm interested in sending my kids to. Check out franciscan.edu today.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Are you fed up with the current healthcare system, paying too much for your healthcare cost? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. Visit SolidarityHealthShare.org to join like-minded Catholics in sharing medical expenses.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical, and in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
Hello, this is Steve Ray. I'd like to invite you to go on a pilgrimage with me. Why a pilgrimage? It's life-changing. It makes the Bible come alive. We have several coming up in the fall and winter of this year. St. Paul Cruz, 9 biblical sites, Mexico and Guadalupe. It's very safe and beautiful, by the way, and many to the Holy Land.
Pick the pilgrimage that's right for you. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the pilgrimage link. There's 2 coming up and a lot more to come. AveMariaRadio.net.
Recently, a 3-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit unanimously ruled that King County's rejection of our client's Faces of Global Terrorism ad violated the First Amendment. The ad included the faces of 16 terrorists found on the FBI's Most Wanted Global Terrorist list, which is posted on the FBI's website. King County, which is located in Seattle, Washington, rejected our client's ad, claiming that the ad was demeaning and disparaging toward Muslims, since all of the listed terrorists, you guessed it, were Muslims. At the time, the FBI's most wanted terrorist list included pictures and wanted posters for 32 terrorists. Of the 32 listed terrorists, 30 were individuals with Muslim names or were wanted for terrorism related to organizations conducting terrorist acts in the name of Islam. In its ruling, the Ninth Circuit held that the county's rejection of the ad based on its disparagement standard was viewpoint discrimination, and that its rejection of the ad based on its disruption standard was unreasonable, all in violation of the First Amendment. Make no mistake, this is an important victory for free speech. Too often we are seeing government officials restricting speech based on claims that is demeaning, disparaging, or offensive. The First Amendment does not allow such censorship, as the Ninth Circuit's opinion makes clear. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
New from EWTN Publishing and just in time for Christmas, it's The Spiritual Wisdom of Mother Angelica. This 7-book box set includes Mother's Quick Guide to the Sacraments, Mother on Christ and Our Lady, her guide to practical holiness, and of course, Praying with Mother Angelica, and more. The Spiritual Wisdom of Mother Angelica, available now at EWTNRC.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We continue in Baltimore at the annual fall meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And to join me right now is Dr. Janet Smith. Janet holds the Father Michael McGivney Chair of Life Ethics at Sacred Heart Major Seminary. She's taking a leave of absence right now in order to dedicate herself to combating this crisis of sexual abuse or poor leadership. There's so many things tied together here. And you can visit her at janetsmith.org. She's also been the consultant and inspiration behind a new organization called No More Victims, which I do serve on the board of. And you can get more information there at nomorevictims.org. Janet, good to have you with me. Thanks.
And it's good to be with you. Can I give you just two slight corrections there?
Please,
Janet,
please.
Janet E. Smith with an E between
Janet
and Smith.
Oh, yes. I missed that. Right. Janet E. Smith.
And then No More Victims, M.I., dot org.
Very good.
No More Victims, M.I. Yes, but good morning.
Yeah, and to you. Let's talk about the organization to begin with. I have not spent a lot of time discussing it on the air. I've mentioned it in passing a few times. What are the origins of No More Victims?
Yeah, this came up with a local lawyer and man who's been involved a lot in the Euthanasia Task Force, Jason Negri, contacting me and say, what can we do? And he actually had an idea from a friend or family member that said, what you need are these local lay commissions that can help victims, help them approach the bishop, help the bishop in how he responds to the victim. And at the same time, to try to make sure there are no more victims. And we're talking here certainly pedophiles, but we think progress is being made, has been made, and that we can all, with these review boards they've set up and the fact that the legal system is very clear on this is wrong and the bishops must report that, and I think they really want to report that now. I think they've come to that point. Mm-hmm. That problem will be dealt with. The problem that we're concerned about are the presence of priests who have sex with males, both young and older, mm-hmm. in dioceses, and how that has created a very toxic atmosphere for promotion of the gospel. Mm-hmm. That these men involved in those lifestyles cannot be the model and witness to the gospel that Jesus wants them to be. They form some kind of, sort of usually a quiet kind of network where they promote each other, and they will actually persecute those priests who are trying to truly live the fidelity of the gospel and maybe even preach against homosexual acts. And it's those men and priests, heterosexual priests, who have preyed upon women, and those priests who are in consensual heterosexual relationships. None of these men can do the job that Jesus wants them to do.
Yesterday, I'm checking my notes here to make sure I get this straight. Yesterday, there was a bishop who stood up and complained that there is a priest globe-trotting right now who explicitly denies the teaching of the Catholic Church when it comes to the morality of same-sex acts. He was clearly referring to Father James Martin, although he did not mention him by name, but there was no doubt who he was referring to. And unfortunately, I'm looking at my notes here, and I cannot identify which particular bishop it was. But that came up.
He's my hero of the hour, but go ahead.
Yes, I'll try to figure out who it was.
Right.
You know, there was no action taken on that, but clearly there are some bishops who are aware that one of the most popular priests right now in terms of the press and even in terms of certain bishops is undermining the teaching of the Catholic Church.
In terms of the Vatican. I mean, he was, as we know, he was a speaker at the World Family Day.
That is right.
It's just, it's outrageous.
And
you know, so he's given some little lip service to the church's teaching and massive amounts of counterindications that's what he believes. And it is a scandal, and it is a scandal to the faithful. And, you know, I would hope that the U.S. bishops would do a study of him. I mean, any sophomore in college could see what he's up to and censor him. Now, of course, I don't know what the Vatican would do about that,
right?
Because the Vatican favors him.
Right.
But at least the U.S. bishops would be on record of saying this man should not be invited to be any kind of representative of the Catholic Church's teaching on homosexuality.
Yeah. In fact, the bishop who brought this up yesterday said that this man travels the country with no resistance from U.S. bishops. So he actually chided his brother bishops on this point. I've ceased calling him Father Martin on the grounds that when Jesus says, call no man father, we usually look at that and we argue an apologetic point against Protestants who might say we're not supposed to use the phrase father. But Jesus was referring to the danger of giving people honorific titles who didn't deserve them. And in this case, my own opinion is I just think we should call him Jim.
Crafty Jim or Sly Jim.
Sly
Jim. Orthodox Jim.
Right.
Things you could call him. Yeah.
Yeah, but don't give him the title of a priest, not when he's undermining the teaching of the church. If he wants to change that. And anybody who says he's not undermining the teaching of the church needs to see what he's written about a group at St. Paul's in Hell's Kitchen. This is a thriving parish that has an, quote, LGBT outreach called Out at St. Paul's. It is they do not permit Courage to advertise in the bulletin. They do have a Courage chapter that meets in the basement. But OSP, or Out at St. Paul's, is really what that parish is about. And they explicitly deny the teaching of the church. The pastor of that church has asked for the catechism to be revised so it no longer uses the word intrinsically disordered. And Martin, Jim, says that this is an ideal LGBT outreach. It's a model outreach. I think we know exactly where he wants to go.
And, of course, the question is, why does Cardinal Dolan permit it?
Don't know. I agree with you.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it, the thing that religious orders do where they call each other to account? I know it's called fraternal correction generally, but what the bishops have to do is they have to have a session every year. That doesn't necessarily have
chapters. Weren't they called chapters?
Chapters where they call each other out.
Yeah.
And they just say, why are you doing this? Why did you do this? Why don't you do that? And do you see it reflects upon all of us that you do this, and it undermines the work of all of us if you permit these things. I mean, whoever that bishop was, my huge congratulations to him, because, you know, it's not just James Martin. It's the bishops who allow him. I believe Schnur did not allow him to conduct
you're right.
in Cincinnati.
You are right.
He did not allow him.
Yes, a fellow from Cincinnati mentioned that to me. I'm glad you pointed it out. He did not let him.
And so, he did not. And so I want to know, why are any of them allowing him to come? They know who he is. They know what he's doing, and they know how he undermines the faithful. What is the upside for them? Whose favor are they currying by allowing him to come? It's on their watch. This territory is their, a certain geographical territory is their territory, and they should not let any wolves into their territory. That's their job. And I just hope all of them get a more of a proprietorial sense of their responsibility for their diocese. Again, they don't answer. They have to answer to the Pope in a certain sense, but ultimately, they answer to God.
Right, right.
And so they have to say, "Is God going to be proud of me that I did this? Is He going to approve? Is He going to say, 'Well done, son'?
Right.
Or is He going to say, 'What the heck?
Yeah.
Why did you allow this?'"
Do you think that those who are permitting somebody like Jim Martin to run around teaching in a way that undermines the teaching of the Church? Do you think it's because they themselves lack confidence in the teaching of the Church, and they don't want to unnecessarily, alienate, people? Maybe they think the teaching of the Church is going to change, which I think is absurd. There's no way the teaching of the Church can go and morally. Approve of same-sex acts. There's no way to get there based on Catholic tradition, right?
Yeah. Right. No, it's not going to change. And but their reasons could be so many. I'm sure that what you're saying is one of them, maybe even major. They don't want to be called homophobes.
Right.
They want to be thought of as welcoming and accompanying. They may not believe in the Church's teaching at all. They themselves may be living in contrast to the Church's teaching. They may not want to offend the gay pastors serving under them.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons can be so many. And, to some extent, getting to the reason is interesting. But let's just keep looking at the fact.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
do they allow him? Not why do they, but let's put it then, they shouldn't be.
Right.
That whatever their reasons are, they're not good enough.
Yeah.
To allow someone like him to go around and sow the confusion and endanger immortal souls, right, left, and center.
Well, this again is what you heard in the tones of people like Sean McKnight, Bishop Sean McKnight of Jefferson City, Archbishop Sample of Portland, Bishop Strickland of Tyler, Texas, and others. While they didn't necessarily attack Jim Martin, what they did do is they urged a return to the teaching of the Church, a sense of the gospel, the personal devotion of the bishops themselves, and their willingness to engage in fraternal correction. There were actually quite a few bishops who mentioned the importance of fraternal correction, and they wanted to be in a church in which that happened regularly. Somebody even raised the question of, can we expect that sometime in the future that bishops will approach other bishops, or a number of bishops will approach a bishop and say, "We think it's time for you to resign"? So they're talking that way anyway. Some are talking that way.
That we won't really have achieved institutional maturity until we've come to that point.
I agree.
Right? It's a matter of really being mature and no longer thinking that once you arrive being a bishop, that's just a step to being a bishop at a more populous see.
Right.
But that you are you're responsible, not just that you are certainly primarily and foremost and entirely responsible for your diocese. But you have a responsibility to the larger church, and the first larger church is your own country. Then the larger church is the whole world.
Right, right. Janet, we're out of time, but let me thank you. And, Chris, we'll be staying in touch about nomorevictimsmi.org. And you can get more information with Janet at janetesmith.org. Thanks, Janet.
Thank you.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical. And in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
Activate Life, LLC is a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and independent distributor of Link. Link is an all-natural supplement that increases metabolism, improves brain function, restores gut health, regulates the immune system, and benefits the skin by providing critical energy to the brain and body on the cellular level. More information is available at ActivateGut.com. That's ActivateGut.com.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
How do I handle difficult family members? When do I correct others? When do I hold my tongue? Too often, we're late in realizing that we mishandle a situation, causing both resentment and frustration. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. And in my new book, Thinking Like Jesus, I tackle these questions and more. Check it out and more of my books at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining me. We're going to continue through this week sharing with you interviews that we did. Some of them are outstanding. Talked with Archbishop Michael Burns of Guam, an old friend who surprised all of us when he ended up being sent over to Guam to settle some huge problems there in Episcopal governance. We're going to be talking to Bishop Joseph Strickland, who was the first man to respond to the Archbishop Vigano letter. That's, again, coming up later this week. And we have quite a bit in the pipeline that we can share with you, conversations with bishops, some of them profound reflections on what the church is looking at. Also, Father Raymond D'Souza, down here for the National Catholic Register and for his journal, Convivium. He'll be with us later this week as well. But follow up on our conversations today by going to AveMariaRadio.net. We have follow-up information on the interview with Christine Ruchel, on her experience as a millennial reporter, Ed Penton's work looking at this from Rome, similar to what we heard from Teresa, and how the U.S. Bishops' Conference looks over there. And then some outstanding reflection on the problem of the U.S. Conference and race. Danielle Brown with me earlier today talking about the pastoral letter on racism, which was originally to be the big news of this conference. That was displaced with the McCarrick, Vigano, Pennsylvania grand jury stories. And so if you want to follow up on any of those topics, go to AveMariaRadio.net. We'll have plenty of material from the National Catholic Register and other media sources helping to explain what's been going on here in Baltimore. And we'll spend the next 2 days on Cresta in the Afternoon continuing to unpack it. So thanks for being with me. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. The executive producer is Nick Tom. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.